Hello, Alaska. This is Pat Race.
And this is Matt Buxton.
And this is a podcast about Alaska. All right. Hey, Matt. How's it going?
Oh, you know, just hanging on and hanging out.
You're that cat poster.
Yeah. Right?
There was, I wonder if, do you think people understand that, like, that are millennials and younger? Or is that just a remnant of a bygone era when we all had, it was like when memes were, when memes were something that you bought in poster form and put on your wall.
I know. And as Marge Simpson says, that cat is probably dead by now.
No. this week we got to experience in a rousing Dan Sullivan speech in the legislature, and I think that's what we're gonna focus on talking about today. You posted through it, and and I found it very entertaining. What were some of the things that jumped out to you?
I think it was like kind of a retread, right? I mean, I think we've been hearing some version of this speech for as long as he's been in office, which is really kind of essentially Republicans good, Democrats bad. You know, it's a little tired and frustrating, especially when the legislature is, you know, organized into two bipartisan majorities, right? There's sort of this growing nod towards this idea that neither political party are necessarily like best suited to oversee the state. There's sort of an agreement that, you know, a combination of ideas from different perspectives is like a good thing. So there's that. I think that, you know, stood out to a lot of people. That was definitely, you know, we heard there's much blame for Biden, Chuck Schumer, Democrats, leftists, progressives, environmentalists.
I was amazed by how many times you said Chuck Schumer. Like, that seemed so irrelevant on the House floor there.
Yeah, and I think it's like, you know, it really reminds me of when he got elected in 2014, where, like, you know, it was really notable to me where, like, every single question that he was asked, he would find a way to bring back it back to Obama. It's Obama's fault, Obama this, Obama that. And I think it's like a recipe that, you know, unfortunately works, right? Like, this guy's had several terms in office now. He's going to be up for election later this year. It's been productive to sort of play the blame game, right? And I think it is a little less effective, though, when, you know, your president is in office. Your party controls both chambers of Congress. You know, your party has a strong hand in deciding, like, every single bit of legislation and sort of executive priority that is coming through. So, you know, it's interesting because, you know, last year we heard all these promises about what Trump was going to mean. We heard about the executive order, right? Unleashing Alaska's energy potential.
Right.
And that executive order was still focused pretty heavily this year, right? And so, you know, it kind of to me speaks to the fact that there's maybe not necessarily been as much delivery on some of those promises as he claimed. And I think there's a real fact that, you know, that a lot of what Trump has meant for Alaska over the last year has not been as good as Sullivan would like everyone to think, right? You know, we've seen massive cutbacks on pretty much every bit of federal spending. You know, we've lost spending for public radio, you know, earthquake monitoring, weather monitoring, you know, veteran services. These are all, you know, energy projects that, you know, dared not to be based on dinosaur fuel.
I'm frankly surprised no one asked him about 8A. Like, that's the amount of money that brings into the state of Alaska alone. Like, that seems like a real, you know, 8A native corporations bring in, is it billions? It's billions.
Yeah.
Many billions.
I mean, it is a massive amount of the outside dollars that come into the state come through those programs.
The thing that I think is interesting here is that, like, he is just sort of like Dan Sullivan playing the Dan Sullivan hits. And he even had his little Biden thing. And he even had an aside in this speech where he said, "Don't worry, I'm not going to tear it up." Because, like, he does the, like, strongman phone book thing where he brings out his single piece of paper with some Biden stuff on it and tears it up and says how bad Biden is and how we're unleashing America. But that's Alaska, and Alaska's... Anyways, It's funny to me, though, because we've already had during Sullivan's tenure, we've already had 4 years of Trump, and we don't have a lot to show for that, you know, and so I don't understand why he thinks all of a sudden now it's going to be better. And it's very interesting to me that we are now a dozen years into Sullivan, and the real, like, where the rubber meets the road, we have fewer jobs, we have higher costs, we have a stagnant economy, and we have out-migration. And, like, that's what Alaska has become under Sullivan. And he's trying to paint this rosy picture of, like, wow, we're really gonna hit it big now. Now we're...
Yeah, it's the Alaska comeback. I think, you know, and one of the really kind of, for me, sort of telling sort of exchanges throughout all of it was questions about healthcare, right? There is, you know, he continues to argue that, you know, the Republicans didn't cut Medicaid. They're not cutting Medicaid. Well, they are, right? You know, they're instituting bureaucratically onerous work requirements, volunteer training, whatever, you know, all what 20 hours a week of something that needs to be, like, documented and sort of fed through a state bureaucracy that's already struggling to deliver food stamp programs, you know? Mm-hmm. And so...
That would be vetted on the state side from, like, a functional standpoint?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
wow.
Yeah, the state would be required to, you know, manage the bureaucracy of all of that.
So that's
to be,
like,
logging the hours, yeah, to be doing all that sort of record keeping.
So that's analogous to, like when Dunleavy passes a thing that doesn't have any funding. It's like an unfunded mandate that they're passing down to the state.
So he'll argue that there's money here or there to help beef up that effort.
Okay.
I'd be skeptical of it because, yeah, you know, we've already had, you know, quote unquote investments into this stuff and it's still continued to struggle. Right. I think the other big element of it too is, like, you know, there's the healthcare insurance tax subsidies, right? So these are the subsidies for people who are self-employed, buying insurance through the healthcare market place. And so the subsidies expired. Democrats were fighting for them. And without them, you know, for a lot of people, you know, those insurance premiums, it's like 100% higher, 400% higher for some people.
Yeah.
It's,
yeah.
And you look
absolutely
at the,
that is
and,
my story.
Yeah. And you look at the enrollment numbers and it's like 10% of people have fallen off that market already. And so.
Right. Those are people making the choice to not enroll because it's too expensive.
Yes. And I think that there's sort of this, like, claim that everything's fine. And I think it really doesn't match, you know, the lived experience for many Alaskans, right? So there's a lot of people who are facing higher costs, who are going to be facing greater sort of roadblocks to accessing services. And I think for a lot of people, I think there's a growing sort of disconnect because on the one hand, Sullivan's saying, yeah, there's some, you know, there'll be some growing pains along the way. But, oh, all this oil jobs are gonna make up for it. We're just going to have so much oil.
Yeah.
And it really rings hollow. You know, there's a recent report from the Alaska Department of Labor that says that, you know, a quarter of all non-federal jobs in Alaska are held by non-residents. I think in the oil and gas industry, it's something like 40% are non-residents. In mining, it's 44%. And those are all, like, some of these really, you know, good-paying jobs are ones that not only, like, leave Alaska, but don't, like, because we don't have an income tax in the state, contribute nothing to the state. For some of these out-of-state employees, there's nothing but costs, right? There's the infrastructure costs that we have that aren't recouped anywhere along the line through these new jobs. And so I think that for the people, for the small business owners especially, who are you know, have that 100 to 400% increase in their health insurance, it's like being told that, you know, oh, great, we're going to have mining jobs is just not, like, a solution, right? And I think that I'm glad that there's a few legislators that were willing to kind of point this out during the question and answer session. But I think it's really apparent. And I think that you see this kind of reflected in, you know, Sullivan has for a long time had, like, these really just sort of, like, middle of the road positive approval ratings in polling. And it's, like, starting to really finally, like, come down in the last year with Trump. And I think, again, it just goes to, like, who are these guys working for, right? Like, this... I think that for a long time, the oil and gas jobs pitch was, like, broadly popular in Alaska because it was, like, so tightly integrated into the economy.
Yeah.
And now it really, you know, because of all the cutbacks already in the industry, it just doesn't feel like the same kind of – it doesn't carry the same weight, I think, as it once did. But Yeah, we'll see, right?
We'll see later this year. In November, right? Yeah. But I think it was a little bit lackluster, though, even outside of that. It felt like a rehash, like you said, his speech did. And then he also just, like, again, chose not to engage. The thing he said last year that really annoyed me was that, you know, last year there were a lot of people being very critical of him not hosting town halls, not engaging with Alaskans, and sort of, like, meaningful public forums. And what his defense was last year is that this is the ultimate town hall. This, me standing up in front of the legislature is, you know, these people represent all of the Alaskans. So essentially I'm meeting with every Alaskan today, right? Yeah. Like, as sort of the framing, which is, you know, the legislature is not a layer between the constituency that he represents and his office. Like, he should be engaging with Alaskans and trying to understand their issues. And like I've been thinking about this a lot because he does, you know, he does these very curated, polished events that, like, don't have a lot of cracks or opportunities for people to speak up. He did meet, and I only heard about this afterwards, but he'd met with the Juneau Chamber of Commerce when he was in town. One woman went and asked him a tough question, but it was a largely supportive crowd. And he just sort of, like, bubble wraps himself and puts himself in these situations where he will not be confronted with a challenging question or with a person who thinks differently. And, you know, I think that that feeds into his partisanship. And I think that that helps to insulate him from, maybe even seeing opposing ideas as coming from, like, a genuine place. Like, he seems to think it's all very performative, right? So Corinne from the Beacon asked a question about, like, hey, did you see the protesters? And he's sort of like, oh, I didn't see them. I mean, I noticed some people with some signs on the way in, and it was, you know, they're exercising their free speech, blah, 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 kind of like these just sort of like gray platitudes. And the thing that he went off about was, like, how many town halls he's hosting. I've hosted so many town halls. I've hosted more town halls than anyone. Mm-hmm. And, like, the idea that he's actually engaging with most Alaskans, I think, is false. Like, he's having events for people that are in his social strata, who are supporting his work, who are benefiting from his work financially. And I don't think he cares to talk to anyone outside of that realm.
Yeah.
So he did an event across the hall at the distillery while he was in town. And I found out about it, like, the day before. So I just put up a big sign on the window that said, "Hey, Dan Sullivan, extrajudicial killings are bad, actually." And I just wanted him to see one little sign of dissent. Right. And I put it in a place where he couldn't miss it. And there were a lot of good, like, guffaws and chortles as people came in the building. But in my imagination, like, someone from some lowly staffer or maybe even Dan himself would, like, come over and be like, "Hey, I noticed the sign. Let's talk about this, right? Let's engage on this. You seem to be concerned about something. Let's talk about, like, what your concern is." Because that's really what the role of a representative is in a representative government, is to be like, "Hey, people are concerned about something. Maybe I should ask them what their concerns are and try to understand them." And that's just not his style at all.
No. So,
yeah.
And I think that's, like, you know, I wrote on Twitter, it's like when he was walking through that hallway with the signs out, that's probably the most uncomfortable he's going to be all year.
Mm-hmm. Right?
And I think that really says a lot about how he views Alaskans, right? And how he views opposition and how he views his duty to engage or not engage with Alaskans.
The one thing that I noticed this year about the folks in the hallway was that it felt like a different crowd. It was a little more animated. There were visibly more young people. You generally, you know, it's 11 a.m. on a weekday. You get a lot of retirees and older activist crowd that shows up to this sort of thing. There were some young folks in the crowd and some people who I don't think had spent a lot of time in the Capitol building, because you could tell they were sort of uncomfortable with the vibe up there. It can be an intimidating place to be, and it can really, like, tune up your emotions.
100%.
One guy yelled at him, "You just love pedophiles, don't you?" And then there was a bunch of booing as he came around the corner. I was like, wow, this is, like, spicier than it has been.
Yeah.
It feels like there's some more, like, cracks in the pavement. You know, it feels like there's a little bit less good than it was last year. And I think last year people were coming into it with this vision of how bad it could be. And now they're coming into it with a vision of, like, hey, yesterday a kid in Soldotna got taken by ICE.
Kindergartner, and which he didn't know about, right? Like he was like, "Oh, claimed he just heard about that." And it's like, to me, that, you know, such a failure. If that's actually true, which I don't believe it is, it's such a failure of his office, right? Like, what? How could you not know about that if you're a senator? Anyways, I do think, you know, one of the frustrating elements of this too, and I think kind of is in, right? Like as you said, as we've sort of seen what the first year of the Trump administration has brought, you know, these ICE deployments to brutalize communities. I think there's a disconnect. And I think what it is to me is it feels like, I think a lot of people want to understand, you know, what it is about everything that is so valuable that it's like worth selling out what you supposedly care about, right? You supposedly care about, you know, the rule of law and the Constitution and these sort of structures of you know, of our society, right? You talk a lot about the Constitution and the rule of law and all this sort of stuff, and then meanwhile you turn around and you're fully in support of ICE and law enforcement and you struggle to have anything negative to say about any of what's going on. I think he did, you know, he did say that he's like, oh, you know, killing Americans. That
crosses the line.
That was pretty bad.
Yeah.
And I think that, like, to me, it's like that shouldn't have to be the motivator to send a sternly worded private email to an official, right?
Well, and that's his defense of everything, right? It's like, have you pushed back? Are you pushing back? It's always like, of course I am, like, super secret private, like. I mean, you guys don't get to see it because I don't say anything publicly, because why I wouldn't do that. But I definitely, like, when you're not looking, I'm doing super good stuff pushing back against these guys. You know, that's I don't, it's so weird. And Senator Dunbar asked a question that I thought was really good. It was just like, how far is too far? Like, when will you say no? And I don't remember the exact example. It was something like about deploying
troops. Yeah, so they sent a Minneapolis-style ICE deployment to Alaska.
Yeah, right. And he didn't even really respond to that. He just started talking about Chuck Schumer again.
Yeah, a reporter asked about it. Mark Sabatini from the Juneau Independent also asked about that during the presser, and he never answered it. Yeah. He just kind of like dances around it. So it's like, you know, it's so frustrating. And I think another interesting element, too, is that he was talking a lot about the SAVE Act. This is the Republicans, voter disenfranchisement bill, to put it charitably. This is making it much more difficult to vote. You have to be providing birth certificates and IDs and all this sort of stuff.
Yeah, from what I've read about that, like it would make it more difficult for women who are married and have changed their name, for anyone who's changed their name, and then also for people that don't have a passport or birth certificate. So there's a lot of people that just, like, because they don't travel, don't have a passport. So who's that going to be? That's going to be the middle class and poorest people in the nation, right? And then
it's a poll tax with more steps. Yeah. And I think, you know, one of the telling things about that was, you know, he even said, you know, he's like, look, you know, this is a thing that really isn't happening in Alaska. We're not saying anything in Alaska is cheating on a major scale. But I support this. And there was a question. It was like, well, if this puts new barriers to voting and it's not needed in Alaska, why do you support it?
Right.
And his answer was, well, I'm an Alaska senator, but I'm also a senator for America. And I think that, like, to me, I mean, Ted Stevens has got to be rolling over in his grave.
Yeah, he really stuck the landing. That was good. Like, yeah, I mean, I might be the senator for Alaska, but man, there's a lot of other stuff out there that's more important to me.
Yeah, and I think that, to me, like, really is, like, so emblematic of this entire presentation, which is just that it felt so out of touch, right, with what is going on in Alaska. And I think that is what happens when you're totally mired in DC swamp politics. Like, he's blaming the DC Democrats for everything, but he is also not taking any culpability for DC Republicans and their role in any of this, right? Yeah. And I think that is what is so frustrating about so much of this, is just like, who is he fighting for, right? Is he just a good Republican? I guess he's a good foot soldier for the Republican Party, and he's doesn't doing a whole lot for the state.
Well, I think if you look at his history, that kind of makes sense. Like, he comes from a family that is a big corporate family. His grandfather started this company that, you know, makes like Rust-Oleum and different, coatings. And his dad was the CEO. His brother is now the CEO.
Cancer causing materials.
Well, yeah. I mean, you gotta have your Rust-Oleum. And he, I think that he looks like the political wing of a prominent corporate family.
I mean, Dunleavy's the same way, right? Yeah. Well, Dunleavy's brother
is not
a dynasty or whatever, but like his brother's this fabulously wealthy investor, yeah.
Right, and he was part of the Enron scandal, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, but that's a little bit different because it wasn't like this like family owned thing where it's like, okay, we're gonna have one kid's gonna run the company and the other kid's gonna go into politics and maybe like snake his way through Alaskan politics and become president one day. You know, I think that there's this kind of different world that we're not part of, where power and politics and corporatism are kind of married, and you need that political influence to keep the corporate influence and. It's not great.
It's gross. I mean, I think that especially at a time right now where I think that like wealth and inequities, this like ownership class that is seemingly completely above, any sort of consequences as we're seeing with Epstein, is really, I think like, really activating and motivating for a lot of people, right? Because I think it,
Did you say it's Epstein? Like
Epstein?
I think it's Epstein.
Epstein, okay.
No, that's fine, whatever. We know who you're talking about.
Yeah, consequence-free with Epstein. Yeah, Epstein. Epstein. Yeah.
It's Frankenstein.
All right.
Okay, so
Epstein's monster.
Yeah, can we talk about the presser that happened afterwards? He doesn't do a lot of interviews, and this has got to be a big deal for the press to like get to sit down and ask him a few questions, because I don't get the sense that he engages with them very much, at least from like reading Liz Ruskin's writing. It seems like there's a lot of frustration in terms of not being able to really get him to answer a question, like just sort of breezing through the reporters and not giving them much. So this is like a once in a year opportunity for some people to sit down and get him hard questions. It felt curated a little bit. Yeah, I don't know. What was your perspective on it as someone who's done that before?
I think there's a difference between like a press conference and an interview where you are allowed to like ask follow-ups, right? Because I think that's like one of the big issues with reporting in politics in general, right? Is that these politicians are like, their entire career is built around being good at weaseling out of answering questions, right?
So you get one question, I'm going to answer a different question than the one you asked, and then move on to the next person.
Yep, and they didn't, and you don't get an opportunity to follow up. So Mark Sabatini with the Independent, he was asking about ICE deployment. I think he also specifically asked like, what do you do if ICE comes to Alaska in the same way that it did in Minneapolis?
Yeah,
never got the answer. Tried to follow up. And then, Sullivan's press person like runs in and grabs the microphone and is like, we're moving on. And so, it's not that it's even then it's still insulated, right? He's still insulated from these sort of tough questions. And I think that some outlets get scared about losing access, right? Like, and it's even like not like you have all this much access in the first place. But, I remember hearing from other people that it's like they were told specifically, like, don't ask about this thing or we're not gonna talk to you anymore. And so that was with Dunleavy specifically. I can't even remember what it was, but there's just a strategy of sort of playing them, right? And I think it's unfortunate. I still think that the press corps did a pretty good job at asking some pretty hard questions. I think it's clearly kind of better when you can ask like a real like narrow question with like a narrow sort of slate of answers that are possible, because I think that the more open-ended a question is, the more open-ended his answers become.
Yeah. But even, so there's a little bit of that there. Even specific questions, it's super easy for him to just, that's what he did with Forrest Dunbar. Forrest Dunbar asked him a very specific question and he just started talking about Chuck Schumer, and then you don't get the answer and you move on to the next thing. So I think that's a good point that you make, that that a press conference or a speech are very much different than an actual interview, than sitting down and having a conversation with someone.
And honestly, you see how uncomfortable he gets, right? Yeah. I think that's what's so interesting about it is that, you know, the questions that the legislators were asking, I think the three really sharp ones came from Representative Mina, Senator Dunbar, Representative Galvin, all asked really good questions on healthcare, on Trump, on immigration and ICE. And you could see he kind of gets under his skin, right, to be challenged. And I think that, like, as frustrating as the few opportunities that we really get to make this very privileged person a little bit uncomfortable, I think those were some sort of sweet moments. And you see him sort of stammering, him sort of get angry about it. So yeah. I think that there's at least that, right? Like, I was sort of joking with the protest pictures. It's like, that's the most uncomfortable he's going to be. But, like, good that, you know, that people aren't letting him be comfortable in every single moment of his life, right? And so I think that there's sort of tough questions that need to be asked.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, like, one of the other ways that I engage with Sullivan is that I frequently get frustrated with something and send a letter in, right? So, like, hey, these people got murdered. That's not cool. Hey, why are we bombing boats in international waters or in another country? You know, I go ahead and send those things in. And then eventually, like, you get a letter back and it's kind of a long-winded form letter. You can tell he's really wonky. Like, he's deep into sort of justifying his decisions. But it feels very, you know, debate and forensics. Like, he's taken up a position and now we'll defend it. And it doesn't really seem like he's invested in much other than winning an argument at this point. And that's, like, kind of tied into that whole partisanship, right? Like, I don't, mm-hmm. when he writes me a letter and says, like, yeah, it's not great that people got murdered or whatever, you know, like, he'll kind of, like, lightly admit that, or, you know, as he did in the press conference, but then he'll go on to say things like, the rhetoric is really what's the problem, right? That people are daring to speak out about law enforcement and ICE, like, that's really turning up the volume and making these things really intense, and that's clearly why bad things are happening, is because people are saying that they don't like what's happening.
Well, I mean, that was interesting too. I mean, there's a lot of the reporters did sort of drill into some of the ICE questions, and yeah, that was where he finally admitted, like, yeah, maybe ICE's, like, training policies could be updated. And I think he, like, was crediting himself for this this Homeland Security bill that, like, I think he said put, quote, a couple million dollars into de-escalation. This is like this is a billion-dollar agency. A couple million dollars is, like, literally nothing. Not literally nothing, it's figuratively nothing. and I think the thing about it too is that, like, you know, everything, even when he was like, you know, the murder of American citizens was, like, not great, and ICE could use some more de-escalation training. He then turns around and it's like, well, you know, you don't see this level of violence or whatever in other communities where the police have bent over backwards to work with ICE. You know, it's really on Minneapolis to bring. And it's just, to me, again, it's just, like, I feel like these people are, like, excuse machines, right? They're just, like, they've spun up the ChatGPT to give them all the excuses possible to deny, deflect. I get the feeling that people are increasingly less likely to buy it.
I like that. Excuse machines. I think that's, yeah, that actually, yeah, that feels right on for this time that we live in. My wife Marion calls these AI chatbots, like, a confirmation machine, where you just go for someone to tell you you're right. It's like being surrounded by yes men, you know. Yeah. It's like, here's the thing that I believe, now tell me why I'm correct.
Yeah.
And that feels like a lot of what's happening right now, and it doesn't feel very healthy.
Yeah.
Okay, so moving on from Sullivan, the legislature's in session. What have you been paying attention to most? What's interesting? What things might people have missed?
Yeah. So actually, speaking of excuse machine, AI powered excuse machines, Mount Edgecombe and the state's handling of it. So one of the big issues that has come up this year is basically the state of the state-run boarding school, Mount Edgecombe. So this is a Sitka high school. It attracts students from all over the state, mostly Alaska Native students living in rural communities. It's produced a lot of, like, really high-profile people, leaders in Alaska Native community. Representative Robin Freer, I think is her new name, is a graduate from there. Several legislators have children that go there. And since the school year started, about a quarter of students, so about 100 students, have disenrolled from the school. There's sort of a myriad of issues, but a lot of it, I feel like, kind of stems to the state, quote unquote, like commandeering the budget. They had a $1.6 million budget deficit. And so the legislators took a kind of unprecedented trip out to the in-session trip to go out and see the school. They've had a series of hearings over the last week. And it's rough. So there's leaky roofs. There's an elimination of tons of extracurricular activities. They eliminated live-in volunteers. I think they only cost like $18,000 for the year or something like that. And now the kids don't have anybody to chaperone them on like afternoon walks or play board games or give them a ride into the town.
There were some photos going around of the building, and it looked really, I'm sure they mostly shared the bad ones, but it was like there was holes in the ceiling and there were just like dirty things. There were rooms that were just full of stuff, like hoarder style. It was it did not look like present as a school from the few photos I saw.
Yeah, and Senator Lyman Hoffman, who's from Bethel, he's one of the kind of big, you know, institutional forces in the legislature, I think he came out of it saying, I wouldn't let my kids go there, you know? And I think it's a pretty bad spot when a school relies on kids to go there, parents to be able to sort of send their kids and trust their kids at this institution. And so the thing is that, like, so then you hear from the administration, Education Commissioner Dena Bishop, and it's just excuse after excuse after excuse about why it's gotten to where it is. Oh, it was a surprise that the budget got out of control. Oh, we just didn't know what was going on there. It was the past people's fault. We just didn't know how important these volunteers were. And it's just all this sort of shit that like kind of doesn't really move the needle forward on anything,
right?
Especially when you have the backdrop of the Dunleavy administration vetoing budget item after budget item after budget item to try to upgrade this, or, you know, repair this school, you know, to do roof upgrades, window replacements, dorm improvements, to get the aquatic center into a usable state. All these sort of things, like, it's like they act like they're surprised that it's gotten to where it is, and then they forget their own context, that they have been in charge for the last 7 years. And
right.
Sure, like, a lot of these problems, you know, a lot of these problems go back a long time with, you know, how Alaska treats services that primarily serve Alaska Native students, right? Like, let's be honest, right? Like, there are problems at Mountain Edgecombe that are the same, if not, you know, worse in rural districts.
Right, public schools in Alaska, like Sleep Mute, where there's rot in the building, and yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Antioch, like, closed their high school because the gym's roof was, like, starting to crack. So, you know, we are, like, things are not okay. And I think that it really stands in pretty stark contrast to the fact that the Dunleavy administration for the last 7 years has, like, insisted that money is not the solution to education, that we don't need to fund these sort of capital maintenance projects, that we just need to right-size schools. And, you know, it's so many excuses when they really just need to own up.
Yeah.
Having some that they had responsibility in getting us to where we are. And I think that lack of accountability is so deeply frustrating, because they're, you know, at the same time that, you know, Mount Edgecombe was, you know, facing its problems, they were blasting Juno. Oh, Juno's just, you know, Juno's, you know, school budget problems are just because they don't know how to manage him. And it's like, every, you know, they argue that all the budget issues around the state are simply due to the poor management, right? And the really, you know, it's just a matter of leadership, not money. And then you turn around, and the one school that they have, you know, that they're directly in control of, is falling apart, you know, right? And students, you know, a quarter of students left, several longtime employees left. You know, the direct situation is really frustrating. And then what it says about education in Alaska is also deeply frustrating.
So what's the management structure? So is Mount Edgecombe, like, Dena Bishop is in charge of it, or like the Commissioner of Education makes all the calls, or is there like a chain of, like, what's the hierarchy there? Do you know?
Yeah. So as more or less as I understand is you have, you have like a principal of the academic wing, you have a principal of like the dorms. They both report to the superintendent, who, thanks to Wasilla Senator Mike Schauer is also the superintendent of another school district in the area. So he's doing double duty. And then he reports to the state school board and Dina Bishop. So they're kind of all in that structure. But so they don't have Mount Edgecombe, unlike other school districts and organized areas of the state, doesn't have its own school board. It has like an advisory panel, I believe. But as we've been finding out, this advisory panel has not been consulted on like several of these changes that have been made rapidly.
So we've got a bunch of excuses, and excuses are backwards looking. What's the plan going forward?
Oh, I'm shrugging right now.
Oh, okay. Just in case anybody can't tell. Shrugging doesn't work.
It really is very unclear, right? And I think it's sort of interesting because, I think the answer, frankly, is that education schools need more money, right? That there is still a severe lack of resources. You know, they increased funding last year, but the story all along was that wasn't even keeping up with, you know, the loss in buying power over the last decade. So like, they're already playing from behind. I think this argument that last year's funding was the end all be all was always short-sighted. We always knew that it wasn't going to be the end of the story. And so I think that, like, you know, it's interesting because you listen to these hearings now and you kind of have them stuck in this sort of uncomfortable spot of admitting that, we kind of do need more money. I mean, the superintendent was talking about, it would be nice to have the money to buy 10 new mattresses a year. There's 400 mattresses. There's 400 beds in this school. So that's a 40-year replacement plan.
Yeah.
So, but I think, and it's like, they, you know, I think one of the frustrating things, I think, for them is that, you know, like, this is a dormitory with a bunch of students. Don't you think you might need a new mattress at some point during the year? So they don't even have, like, a box of, like, a couple mattresses spare at the school. And they're scrounging to replace 10 of them.
Well, they probably got a lot of extra mattresses now that they lost a quarter of their students. I mean, there's that upside, right?
I sort of wouldn't be surprised if that's part of the thing.
Well, okay, so here's the strange thing in all of this to me is that, Alaska has a terrible history with taking people out of villages and putting them into boarding schools, and there's a lot of abuse and all kinds of terrible shit happened. And Edgecombe is a little different. Like, it sort of like exists within that model, but like, I've heard a lot of praise for Mount Edgecombe from Alaska Native people I trust, and people who have gone to school there like it, and they're, you know, proud graduates of Mount Edgecombe who have gone on to do, as you said, have gone on to do great things. So the thing that's confusing to me is it seems like the Dunleavy administration has been very pro, like, let's move everyone, let's centralize education, let's get people out of villages and into specialized schools that are regional hubs. Like, why wouldn't they want to make this like the example of, like, this shining example of like how their strategy for education works instead of just driving it into the ground? Is that like, are they intentionally mismanaging Mount Edgecombe for some like purpose that I don't understand, or are they just really bad at this?
I think that a lot of what we are seeing this year with, you know, whether it's Mount Edgecombe, whether it's the fiscal plan, whether it's the PFD, all this sort of stuff, I think that there's kind of the kind of core problem is that Dunleavy's just not very interested in making hard decisions or like having any sort of like granularity in any detail. And a lot of his leadership style, I think, is very like, you know, top-down dictates kind of thing going on, where, you know, you look at the fiscal plan and you look at his year one budget, it's a really good example, is that his entire, the entire and complete direction he seemed to give to Donna Ardoin and the budget team in that first year was, give me a big PFD and I don't want to pay any taxes. And so when legislators were pleading for, like, why are you cutting K-12 education by 20%. Why are you cutting the university by nearly a 40%, I think is what it was. The answer was, well, our directions were big PFD, no revenue. And I think that's really what is going on here. I think that Dunleavy basically has said, I don't want to put a single extra dollar to education, right? And because he's trying to prove a point that money isn't important and it's really about charter schools and homeschools and whatever, And it's like, even those programs are honestly struggling in a lot of ways. But I think they're really committed to just, like, living within our means, right? Like, the order from on high is, we live within our means, we're not going to spend any more money towards this. And I think this is kind of the result, the on-the-ground result that you see. And I think that it's important to keep in mind that, like, the reason that, like, Mount Edgecombe's extracurricular activities have been, like, slashed, like, across the board is because they had a $1.6 million deficit, right? Like, again, chump change in the grand scheme of things. And I think that, you know, it's like, if there was the will to supplement that funding in some other way to like make sure that the kids can go on their debate trip or have people to hang out with them, like, they would have found it, right? And to me, it really speaks to this, like, lack of flexibility within this sort of rigid worldview that Dunleavy has sort of painted him into, himself into. And I think, you know, it's, you go, you listen to the superintendent of it talk, and he's like, yeah, it would be great to have more money. We could open another dorm. There's demand for, you know, there's more demand for this. It would be great. And you can kind of see Dina Bishop sort of sitting there looking a little uncomfortable that, you know, it's like, oh, he's kind of, you're not supposed to say that part, right? Like, right. We all know that that's an important part of it, but we can't admit that money actually fixes it. It's just such a, like, ingrained way of thinking for them that I think they're really refusing to engage on it.
Right. That puts them in an awkward, in an awkward position to come to the state and be like, hey, we need more money for education after they've been cutting education.
Yeah. And I think, too, I think, you know, you're starting to see it with a lot of the way legislators are approaching Dunleavy and handling him. You know, I think that, you know, there's been comments that are like, we're just going to have to wait till we have a new governor.
Yeah, right? I've heard that multiple, like, times from people. We have to wait him out.
Yeah. But, you know, like, I've seen senators post the number of days until the next governor's inaugurated, right? Yeah. Like, I've seen, there's literally comments that say, you know, we're just going to have, Mount Edgecombe's going to have to wait until we have a new governor. And I think, they're not wrong, yeah. Right?
Yeah, this legislative session is entirely like case building for the next administration. Whoever comes in,
100%.
Whoever comes in, I mean, going to have to be responsive to what's happening in the legislature this year.
Yeah, and I think too, you know, it's like there's this education working group that the legislature stood up last year. It very obvious, you know, that it's very telling that the report isn't due until 2027, right? That is literally for the next governor. There's a lot of other areas that are like that are just trying to get through it, you know?
Yeah. Okay. As we started the show, you were telling me an important journalistic precept that you have neglected. What is that?
That is get the name of the dog.
Right.
And it's sort of this, it's like this long, you know, all journalists, you should hear this at some point. Just like everybody should know that you need to get those sort of details. And in this example,
yeah, what's the name of the dog?
We stumbled at the media court. The press corps stumbled. The name of the rat that lives in the corner of the Mount Edgecombe gym is not Twinkle Toes, his name is Tiptoes.
Tiptoes,
okay. Tiptoes. So get the name of the rat, yeah.
All right, is that named by the students or is that Dina Bishop named him?
That is the name that is given to this rat by the students.
That's amazing. I think that's a really key piece of this story is that, like, this school is in such a state that there's a rat living in the corner of the gym that everyone knows by a common name like that.
Yeah. Well, and I think, you know, and in the bigger, more grim, less funny picture is that, yeah, like, a lot of these students are here because they don't have those sort of opportunities at home.
Yeah.
They are there because there's, you know, a lot of rural schools are, frankly, in a worse condition than Mount Edgecombe, right? There are ProPublica and KYUK, I think, did a large report last year looking at, like, moldy classrooms. We heard testimony this year during one of the fly-ins that, like, students are having trouble learning because they're so sick. They're getting sick from the smell of raw sewage from pipes bursting in their classroom or in their school. And, you know, the fact that, like, someone can look at this and say, this is the appropriate level of funding and resources to put into the system is really, really galling to me. And I think that, you know, as we look forward to who is our next governor, I think that these sort of questions should be really front and center for them. It's not, you know, personally, it's like, until those kids can have the proper education, I don't give a shit about my PFD, right? Like, to me, there's a prioritization here in a lot of it that, you know, we are really losing sight. And I think that it's frustrating that, you know, the PFD has become the easiest to pull lever in balancing the budget. But that is like a simple fact of life when we have a governor and a political party that are unwilling and to institute any sort of new revenue, right? So where are we going to get the money to, you know, pay for kids to go to debate class or not, or to sleep on a new mattress, right? Like, where are we getting that money in? And I think for legislators, the easiest dial to turn is the PFD. I know it's an unfortunate way of, you know, it's a regressive way of raising revenue. But for me, you know, I think that, you know, there are really important things that are not getting funded right now. And I think that it's a real shame.
I mean,
and
I
it
like,
should be a shame.
I like the sentiment there, but I'm not into that. Like, I think right now in our budget situation,
I mean, we should be paying taxes. There should be some taxes.
We have
right?
a fiscal crisis right now. And, you know, like we did this great interview years ago, a couple of years ago with Cliff Groh, and where he talked about the various constituency groups, right? And
yes,
he had like
good,
the Groh Square. And, you know, right now the fiscal crisis is being balanced on the back of like middle class and poor Alaskans, because who relies on the state services that have been cut? And who relies on the dividend checks that go out? And that's the people with the least amount of money and the most need for those services. And so the people that haven't been paying to help fund these schools and fix these problems are the oil companies and the mining companies and the wealthiest Alaskans.
Out-of-state workers, yeah.
Yeah, and Hillcorp, like the giant S corporation that's like skirting our, I mean, it's not even a loophole, it's just sort of the way our tax laws work. And
yeah,
so
it's what happens when you don't have it. I mean, the S corp loophole would be closed in a second if you just instituted an income tax.
Right, yeah, an income tax solves that problem. It's not a loophole, it's just that we took our income tax off the books. Yeah. So anyways, I think that yes, like sentimentality, I would give up my PFD for these students to have a place.
Yeah, my PFD
a
could
school
buy
without a
three mattress
without,
three or four
without
mattresses,
a rat in
yeah.
it. But like, but yeah, but at the same time, like, let's think about who we're asking to pay for what.
Okay. And I think that, you know, my comments are you know, I think a reflection of just the frustration that, you know, we're sort of being told, well, it's like if we're going to wait for new revenue, then we're going to be waiting forever, right? I think that's sort of the frustrating position here is like, yes, reworking our sales or reworking the oil taxes, income tax or some sort of broad-based tax would be excellent. Don't get me wrong. But in the meantime, it's like I just don't know. It's just so frustrating to tell these kids that, like, these kids don't get to have a second shot at being a junior, right, in high school, right? Like, they will have graduated with this experience that we have right now as their experience. Like, and so I think there's, like, a level of really it's all to say that, you know, what is it, December 4 or whatever the inauguration date just can't come soon enough.
On that note, wasn't there an introduction of a head tax for education that was sort of a graduated head tax? Did you listen to that? What was that one?
Yeah. So the other big thing this session, right, is that the governor has a fiscal plan bill that was pretty much dead on arrival, right? It's this very bizarre, frankly, very bizarre plan where it goes back again to big PFD, and this time it's no taxes on wealthy people. There, you know, the governor's introduced a plan. It would enshrine a pretty large PFD in the Alaska Constitution, while simultaneously instituting a pretty steep sales tax, as well as phasing out all corporate income taxes altogether, and
putting a stricter cap on government spending,
and doing it and kind of doing it all in a way that, like, if it doesn't really work out, the corporate income taxes are going to get slashed, but that sales tax is probably going to stay around. So, like, let's be honest with how that plan works. So everyone on all sides of the spectrum have basically said hell no to it, especially because it's like there's a lot of people for whom this idea of paying a tax to pay a PFD is just like a bridge that they won't cross. Even as much as they support a PFD, they hate taxes more. So what has happened, though, is that it's gone through, leave it to Kathy Geisel and Senate resources to like try to salvage it, right? And so what they've done is they've dropped the sales tax, they've dropped all the sunset, so it's not going to like have a corporate income tax rate that's going to be, you know, or eliminated like well after Dunleavy's out of office and he doesn't have to deal with that fallout. So that's no longer in there. What it does is it implements, basically a head tax. So Alaska used to have this where I think it's in the first and third paycheck of the year or something. I can't remember exactly the specifics of it, but twice a year you'd get a payroll deduction that would go to education. This would do the same. I think it ratchets from $10 a year to $30 a year. So not very much, right? But enough to actually kind of make some differences here and there. Also, it would capture income from all these, you know, the 25% of people who don't live here at all. So there's that. I think it's interesting. I think that it's definitely like an attempt at making like a workable plan. The chance of it really going anywhere again, I feel like it's an exercise really, again, teeing up this sort of legislation for the next governor.
Here's an idea for next time. Put it on an idea pile.
Let's do some work on it. Because that's frankly like kind of the problem with this sort of two-year legislative cycle is that like the first year is frequently spent like by people getting sort of spun up and to understanding these issues because, you know, people are coming from, you know, all sorts of backgrounds, levels of knowledge of how Alaska is. And so then the second year when they're finally kind of maybe knowledgeable enough to do something, it's an election year. We couldn't do it during an election year because we don't want to not get elected. And so they need to find some way to sort of break out of that. And I think that sort of building the groundwork for some of these things is important. And, you know, it's also important to remember, right, like that it wasn't too long ago that the House did pass an income tax, right? Like it was under Walker. I think the Senate kind of got skittish about it in the end. But, you know, it's not impossible for the state to balance its books. It's not an impossible task. It just takes like the will and the possibility that knowing it can get done. And the fact that Dunleavy is a dead end on it has been, you know, it's really snuffed out a lot of the conversations before they really can catch any momentum.
Yeah, I think an interesting move, and I don't know that this is even something that could happen this year, but I think an interesting move would be if the legislature could put some kind of an advisory question on the ballot, you know, that drives that backstops their work next year, right? So if it's an advisory question that goes to like, to the concept of government funding, like should the legislature institute a broad-based income tax and increase oil taxes, maybe even several kind of questions or options so that the voters can sort of backstop their ideas and support them in doing the thing that they're quite obviously like unable to do. Well, I mean, not just because of the shape of the legislature, but because of Dunleavy. I think actually the legislature could do some of this stuff if he weren't an obstacle, but I think that it would give them public backing and it would also create sort of this public debate around how do we solve our problems in a way that we haven't really had. I think it putting a question on the ballot means that then interest groups are going to form around that question and they're going to have to advocate for the answer to that question that they prefer. And so I think that makes it brings that debate into like crisp public focus. And I think that would be, I don't know what the exact wording necessarily would be, but I do think that having an advisory question that you know, it doesn't need to have teeth, but like to poll the Alaskan public on solutions to the problem might be useful.
I mean, I think it's interesting too when you look at like, you know, Dunleavy and this fiscal plan. You know, he has not really made any case for it. If you look at a lot of his communications or his editorials that he's done on it, he doesn't mention that there's a sales tax in it. Like, you'd have to know about that from other people. And I think it, like, really, to me, like, indicates, like, a lack of courage on it.
Well, it's going to be embarrassing for him. He's the no tax guy, and he just introduced a bunch of taxes.
And what I think it, like, really stands in pretty stark contrast to the Bill Walker roadshows, the fiscal plan roadshows. Yeah. And it was really an effort to, like, try to build some collaborative talk around the cuts we need to make, the balance and the revenue we need to make. And, you know, like, I think that, you know, he stuck his neck out there and he paid the price for it. But I think that, like, he did sort of, you know, the most progress we've made on a fiscal plan was under Walker, right? It was with the creation of the POMV, which allows the permanent fund to fund government in a structured way.
Yeah, he wasn't afraid to advocate for his position, and he wasn't afraid to listen to people that disagreed with him. And I think that, like, Dunleavy very much just wants to be like, I've got an idea, do it, I'll come back later, I hope it's done. And then he just checks out.
And
like,
it's not all just shit on
he's
it.
Very,
yeah.
Well, he's very uninvolved. Like, he just sort of, like, throws a little spaghetti, not even that much spaghetti, throws a little, like, a noodle at the wall and then, like, takes off for a while and then, like, shows up again and, like, does some other new random thing because he talked to someone on a hunting trip. And it's just, it's very, like, checked out management. And, I mean, I don't know. Okay, we talk about Dunleavy enough. I would like to wrap this episode up. And the one thing that I would like to circle back to is you mentioned the, you know, name the dog. And I think the best example of that this year was the Chilkat Valley News. Roger McChesney wrote an article about an avalanche that happened there. And in this, in the middle of this avalanche article where these cars got stuck in the snow, no one had any fatalities or anything like that. It was a, but the, in the middle of this article, it says it was Shannon Franey and her two chickens, Bronze and Toothless, who seemed just as surprised as Brumfeld to find themselves atop an avalanche. And I just, you know, that just really brought the, it brought the story into focus of like, oh, okay, this, there's this lady driving down the road with her pet chickens that have like names and they're in the car and now they're all of a sudden they came around the corner and they're up on this big snow pile. And for whatever reason, I think, you know, I think that you're right. I think that like getting those kind of details and understanding the people involved and the names of the animals involved and all of that stuff, that level of detail, I think shows so much care and interest. And yeah, I just, I like seeing that. So thanks for both sharing the name of the rat with me and for helping me to recall this great article.
Yeah, that reminds me. I was just at the Anchorage Museum and they had an exhibit on dogs. And
I saw it.
Very fun exhibit, and there was some really interesting stuff just about like the history of naming dogs and how you name them, you know, and how it's changed. What was also really touching, I think, was like the tenderness that is almost humanly universal that we treat dogs with. It, you know, there are communities that, you know, treat dogs as individuals that have their own interpersonal relationships with everybody, and they're, you know, independent beings that, you know, deserve some respect. And I think that, like, kind of is sort of an aspirational sort of thing. It's like if we can treat dogs well and sort of understand the their complex sort of emotions and well-being, then hopefully we could do that for our fellow person too, right? Like, I think that those are sort of values that I think we are, you know, that are important and really makes us who we are.
Yeah. Great. That's a good note to end on. All right. Well, I'll talk to you later.
And you've got a little bit of presence there too.
I've got a what?
A presence at the museum.
Oh yeah. Well, I have.
So if you go to the museum, go upstairs and see the humor.
I have a giant postcard there.
There's a couple pat races in there.
my Tanzanite postcard.
We walked in there and Chando goes, look who it is. And I'm like, she was pointing to your Tanzanite thing. Yeah. And I was looking at the totem wavy arm guy. And there's a totem wavy arm. I didn't even see that. She didn't even recognize it at first. It's like, Pat. And anyways.
That's funny. Yeah, it was great. I got to, I hadn't been up. I just went up in January and I got to go there and check it all out. It was a great exhibit. But the dogs exhibit was so charming. It was just like there are these amazing paintings. Some of them are like incredibly realistic and some of them are just like people trying their hardest. They're just painting their little hearts out. And it's like, here's a big fluff pile with some eyeballs on it. And it was so good. Yeah. So good.
Yeah. It was so good.
All right. I'll talk to you later. Have a good
day.
Take
care, everybody. Go pet a dog.